Our third case this morning is United States against Hendricks. Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Jerry Flynn. I represent James Hendricks on this appeal. Mr. Hendricks was convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm. At sentencing, it was determined that he was an armed career criminal, and he was sentenced to 188 months imprisonment as a consequence. Mr. Hendricks has raised several issues on appeal. I would first like to address the issue with regard to the district court's denial of the defendant's motion to suppress and reject the firearm. The standard of review on these issues for findings of fact are clear error. Mixed questions of law and fact are de novo review. The facts are basically Mr. Hendricks and his fiancée were in Lowell, Indiana at approximately 4:30 in the morning. They had driven there from Gary, Indiana. They were, as you know, Lowell, Indiana is a small town about 45 minutes to an hour south of Gary. Both of them are African Americans. They had driven there. They'd been in an argument, and they were simply driving. According to their testimony, uncontroverted testimony, they arrived in the town. They were arguing over the fact that Mr. Hendricks had failed to pick up his fiancée for work. They were, quite frankly, in a passionate relationship. They were arguing. Mr. Hendricks discovered a firearm in the vehicle. Upon finding or discovering this firearm, he immediately put it down. An argument ensued because he knew, in fact, that he was in grave danger being a convicted felon.
Whose vehicle was it?
Pardon me?
Whose vehicle was it?
The vehicle had been stolen. Mr. Hendricks was unaware of that. He was never charged or convicted.
He was unaware of that. He didn't notice that it wasn't her car and that it was being driven using a screwdriver rather than a key.
He testified that he knew that it was not her car. He didn't realize until he was in Lowell that the car had in fact been stolen. Again, Mr. Hendricks was never charged with that particular offense. In any event, and again, these are uncontradicted facts. The government has no evidence to contradict this. Both Mr. Hendricks and his fiancée testified at the trial and at the suppression
hearing. You keep using the word fiancée.
That's Marlissa Barnes.
It's a euphemism, I assume, given that they had been living together for more than 6 years and had multiple children.
Well, I'm describing that as they described it.
This is not an ordinary use of the word fiancé.
Well, it's the words that they used, and I'm, as a human being, tendering that respect to them. Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the fact, without question, it's uncontroverted that Mr. Hendricks touched the gun briefly. There's been no evidence to the contrary. There was a lady, a manager of a local gas station, who observed Mr. Hendricks get out of the car, go to the phone, and start making some calls. The way the police were notified was through an anonymous tip from a newspaper delivery person who stated that she'd seen some suspicious activity. Basically, what she told the police was she saw a black man in a white car and that they had been parked behind the a local business and that they had been parked in two different directions and that maybe you ought to go check it out.
Where was the telephone he was making these calls from?
Well, this was all prior to him making the telephone calls. The calls, the phone booth was right on the main street of Lowell, right in front of one of the local businesses.
And when did he make these phone calls?
He made the phone calls after he had discovered the fact that there was a gun in the vehicle. He got out of the vehicle, went to make the phone calls, He was attempting to contact, according to his testimony, his aunt to come pick him up. At some point, he decided he better get back into the vehicle. He got back into the vehicle, and almost immediately, the police officer who had been notified through the Lowell dispatch that there was this, you know, alleged suspicious activity going on, pulled in behind.
So the phone calls were made between his being seen at the oil exchange and their encounter with the police officer at the neighboring station?
Yes. Yes.
Well, is the stop we're talking about, or alleging stop, did that occur before or after the phone call?
It occurred after.
So it was the phone call made at that gas station?
Yes. There were phone calls made.
Well, I know, but when the officer pulled
It was another business. They got into the vehicle.
Put it in context of this stop that you're...
Okay, they pulled out of the gas station. And then the police officer... This is when the police officer saw them. And then he pulled into another business, and then and Melissa Barnes, the fiance or girlfriend, was driving, and she pulled into the she saw the police officer, and she stopped, and the police officer pulled in behind her. She got out of the vehicle, approached the police officer, was indicating that she was having trouble, she was lost, having trouble with finding I-65. The legal issue is whether there was a stop. Whether the...
Now, where were the phone calls made?
The phone calls...
When were they, and that's the sequence you've just recounted in answer to Judge Magnus.
They would have been
at the
gas station prior to him getting back into the vehicle and then pulling out and then having the fiancé pull out onto the main street, and then the police officer saw them, and then we would assert stopped them at that point. So the phone calls were made prior to him getting back into the vehicle.
At the oil exchange?
Yes. We would first assert that the police officer didn't have a sufficient basis to execute a stop. The government has asserted that he, in fact, did not stop the vehicle, that the vehicle stopped voluntarily. The reality is that the police officer was right behind him. The police officer all but testified that he was going to stop them. In his words, though, and in the government's position, is that he just stopped, that the vehicle stopped, and they didn't have an opportunity he didn't have an opportunity to effectuate the stop because they did it anyway. We would argue that, in fact, a stop was made, and if the court finds that the stop was not made at that point, the officer almost immediately called for backup. And within approximately 30 to 40 seconds, backup came, and then the lights came in with the lights. The government's asserting because the police officer who conducted the initial stop didn't have his lights on, this was, in fact, a stop, and that both Mr. Hendricks and Marissa Barnes were free to leave at any time. The reality is they were not.
Well, did the second police officer show up during the conversation between the officer and whatever her name was?
Marissa Barnes, yes. They were in the process of engaging in a discussion between their two vehicles. Mr. Hendricks was sitting in the vehicle at this time when the second police officer arrived.
When she got out of her car, was the police officer out of his car?
No.
But she came back and encountered him and asked about directions for
right.
I-65.
He was sitting in his vehicle when she began approaching. It appears from the record that he then got out of his vehicle and that they were discussed both standing outside of their vehicles at this time. The police officer said that she appeared nervous it was, in his words, raising his suspicions at this point. So the first issue is whether this anonymous tip of a black man engaged in suspicious activity would have warranted a stop. We would argue that it would not. At that point, they did not have, under the Terry analysis, reasonable suspicion with articulable facts to effectuate a stop. And if the stop wasn't made initially by the first officer, it certainly was made the second time when the officer came in with the lights. We do not believe that they had reasonable basis to conduct the stop. The government relies upon a case called U.S. v. Pavlovsky. It's basically the same facts, but it's distinguishable. And the facts are almost identical, and we would ask the court to rely upon that. It's distinguishable in one important point, that the backup police officers in Pavelski did not have their lights on. In this case, the second responding officer did have his lights on. And so if the stop wasn't, if the court finds that there was not an initial stop, which we would argue somewhat disingenuous because the police officer had pulled in directly behind him and had every intention of stopping him, and then once he did pull behind him, it's just disingenuous to argue that they could have just driven away, that they were free to go, because they were not. But the second police officer who came in, almost immediately, and this second officer was called by the first officer as backup, he came in with his lights blazing. So if there wasn't a stop initially, there certainly was a stop at that point. And we still would argue that there was not sufficient basis at that point to be questioning them, to be searching them. The second issue I'd like to raise with the court was the court's denial of... dealt with the jury instructions. The defendant, Mr. Hendricks, objected to the trial court's refusal to modify the pattern instruction dealing with possession. Specifically, based on the facts of this case, we would asserted that the or the Mr. Hendricks asserted that the it was a misstatement of the law in the sense that momentary possession, and this is what the government relied upon in their closing argument, is sufficient to convict. Momentary possession of the gun is sufficient to find someone guilty of being a felon in possession of a firearm. Well, in reality, if you're going to recognize an innocent possession instruction, and the facts of this case are, again, Mr. Hendricks discovered the gun, and he immediately put it down in the vehicle and got out of the vehicle.
That's his version,
but it's an uncontradicted version, and it is somewhat supported by the manager of the local business who was watching it. She watched him get out. They were clearly in a fight, and he went over and he made some phone calls. So certainly that's his version, but it's an uncontradicted version. It's also Marlissa Barnes' version of events. Both of them testified somewhat consistently about how this all transpired in the vehicle. And certainly the jury should have been entitled to, if the jury's entitled to reject their testimony, of course, but the whole argument here is if they accepted their testimony, the way the jury was instructed, they still could have found him guilty. Because they were not aware that if, in fact, it exists, and the Seventh Circuit, quite frankly, has not fully address this issue of whether there is an innocent possession defense to this charge. Certainly in dictum...
One might imagine an innocent possession defense if the possession occurred only during the time the felon was taking the gun to the police and turning it in, for example. But that doesn't appear to be the situation here. The other innocent possession cases we've had are claims that the weapon had to be grabbed and used in self-defense, in extremis. And that obviously wasn't the case here either.
Well, you have a full range of factual possibilities. That one that's come up in the cases are a convicted felon sees a bunch of kids playing with a firearm, and he goes and grabs the firearm from them. And then immediately tries to... The government's solution here would be for Mr. Hendricks to throw the gun out of the window. That's absurd. If Mr. Hendricks has to do that to be able to invoke the innocent possession...
The Supreme Court's view of what's necessary for a justification defense is fundamentally that after the immediate urgency has expired, the person must immediately go to the police. And that obviously wasn't done here. There was no effort to take this gun to the police or any law enforcement agent.
I would ask you to look at it in the context of the fact. This happened extremely quickly. We're talking about he realizes the gun is in the car. he puts the gun, and we have to work with his version of events, and I understand that perhaps the jury and even this court may have questions about that, but the point is we don't know exactly whether the jury believed him or not. And so we'll work with those facts. But under his facts, he saw the gun, he grabbed it, he put it down, and he immediately exited the car. And he began making phone calls. Yes, at some point he came back in the car. And this is where
his
we have...
phone calls were not to the police.
No. But I would ask the court to use some common sense here, in the sense that he is... he's an African-American in a small town in the Midwest that's predominantly white. He has several felony convictions. He's not an educated person. Is he going to walk down to the police? In his mind, if he walks down to the police station with his gun, he's going to be arrested. He took sufficient... under his version, he tried to get rid of it. He tried to put himself, get rid of the gun, and distance himself from it. He made efforts to do that. And if the jury believed that, if they believed his version, we would assert that the innocent possession defense would have applied here.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn.
Thank you.
Mr. Kirsch.
May it please the court. I intend to address the two issues that were raised by appellant here at oral argument. First, the motion to suppress, and second, the jury instructions. However, I do note before I get into those that the version of facts that the defendant pursued at trial and that he continues to pursue here on appeal are fundamentally at odds with the evidence. The defendant continues to maintain that a magazine was never located in his pocket. The defendant maintains innocent possession. He maintains that he should not have gotten obstruction of justice enhancement. He maintains that he should have gotten acceptance of responsibility, but he forgets that when he was arrested, a 9mm fully loaded handgun was found at his feet, and in his pocket was a fully loaded 9mm magazine. When he got back to the police station, a single 9mm bullet that matched the bullets that were found in the gun and that matched the bullets that were found in the magazine in his pocket was also recovered from his pocket. As to the legal issues regarding the motion to suppress, this was not a stop. It was a consensual encounter. Miss Barnes, who I'll refer to as the defendant's fiance to distinguish her from the defendant's girlfriend, who the government maintains he could have been calling when he made the phone calls from the payphone, not his aunt, pulled into the gas station. Officer Swisher observed this from approximately 50 feet away. At that time, Officer Swisher was armed with the following information. There was a white car with a black man in it parked behind the Oil Express. The description of the car and the description of the occupant of the car were merely identifiers. Officer Swisher saw a white car pull from behind the Oil Express and pull into the gas station. As described in the government's brief, these three businesses are within about 100 to 200 yards of each other. Officer Swisher followed the car into the gas station. Officer Swisher never activated his emergency lights, and Officer Swisher never shined a spotlight on the car or anything to that effect. As soon as Officer Swisher pulls in behind Ms. Barnes jumps out of the car and starts approaching Officer Swisher. Highly unusual behavior. Certainly highly unusual behavior if this was in fact a stop. Officer Swisher gets out of his car. At some point, Officer Swisher calls for backup. It's approximately 6 o'clock in the morning, and a shift change is about to take place in a very small town with a very few number of police officers. In fact, Officer Swisher is a detective and was in uniform that day, as he explained at the suppression hearing, because of the shortage on the Lowell Police Department. Officer Swisher radios for backup. Certainly radioing for backup did not constitute a Fourth Amendment stop. Ms. Barnes approaches Officer Swisher and engages in a discussion with him, somewhat of a discussion. She's asking him for directions to I-65. He's asking her what she's doing behind the Oil Express. She refuses to answer his questions. He's trying to keep an eye on the passenger of the car, and as he's doing so, Ms. Barnes is continually stepping in front of Officer Swisher to obstruct his view to the passenger. Right there, Officer Swisher had reasonable suspicion that something was up.
Is that when he called the backup?
It's unclear exactly when he called for backup, but it's certainly clear that backup did not arrive until the conversation was ongoing. And as soon as the conversation began, Ms. Barnes was asking him for directions, and he was asking her what she was doing behind the Oil Express. She was nervous. Her hands were shaking. Of course, at this point, she knew that the gun was in the car. She knew that the defendant had been convicted of 5 armed robberies.
Mr. Kershaw, suppose, I'm changing the facts on you now, but okay. Suppose Officer Swisher had just been on patrol and had seen that car behind the oil exchange that hour of the morning, place of business is closed. Drives past it again, the car is still behind it in a different position. In other words, the same facts the newspaper person saw. Would the officer have been within his rights to drive into the oil exchange, get out of his vehicle, ask the driver for identification papers to the car and ask what they're doing there at that hour of the morning with the place closed?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why are you then not arguing that the stop was a Terry stop long before the point you just mentioned in reply to my brother's question?
Well, I could make that argument, Your Honor, but I think it's very clear that it was not a stop, that it was a consensual encounter. I think that the police officer had reasonable suspicion, armed with the information that he had from the caller. Now, the difference between your facts and the facts in this case are the facts that the newspaper lady called in this information. Mm-hmm. The only thing that Officer Swisher saw was a white car that was identified by a newspaper lady, who at that time was unknown to the Lowell Police Department, who said she saw a car first facing east, and then she delivered some papers, came back, it was first facing west.
Then the officer came out, and where did he see the car?
The officer came out and saw the car pulling out of the Oil Express parking lot.
Bingo.
Which corroborates what the caller
so
said.
So we don't have an anonymous tip anymore, do we? We have a tip by a person who apparently at least identified herself, followed by the police officer's visual verification that what she had seen, in fact, had happened.
Well, that's correct. The officer saw the car pulling out from behind the Oil Express. At that point, I do think the officer had reasonable suspicion to conduct the stop. The officer also was armed with the information that there had been a rash of burglaries in the Lowell area around the period of the stop, which is part of the totality of the circumstances, I think, in this case. The car was parked behind an Oil Express, which was obviously closed, at approximately 5 to 5:30 in the morning. So to answer your question, I think the answer is yes. The officer had a reasonable suspicion to conduct a stop. In the defendant's reply brief, he says the government agrees with him that the officer did not have reasonable suspicion at that point. I think the government does not agree with that. But in any event, I think the encounter between Barnes and Hendricks and Officer Swisher was a consensual encounter. Even after Officer Burke, who was the second officer to arrive, pulled up, which may have been 30 seconds to a minute after Officer Swisher arrived at the gas station, the second officer had his lights on. That was not a stop when the second officer pulled up. There's a case in the Tenth Circuit, United States versus Langston, which says that if an officer pulls up behind a car, such as in this situation, and then activates his emergency lights, that doesn't necessarily constitute a stop. A police officer, and Officer Swisher would have been justified in activating his emergency lights in the parking lot. There are a lot of reasons for activating emergency lights that have nothing to do with executing a traffic stop, such as officer safety.
The officer who turned his lights on knew he was being called as a backup because the officer on the scene thought he was in an insecure situation.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the officer on the scene relayed to backup.
He knows he's being called as a backup.
He knows he's being called
as
a backup.
He knows the officer on the scene wanted some help.
It's unclear exactly what he knows. There were some radio problems. Officer Swisher tried to call for backup directly and was unable to do so. So he had to call the dispatch, who then relayed the message to backup. So it's unclear exactly what the backup officer knew. But the backup officer at no time pulled in behind Ms. Barnes, or excuse me, pulled in front of Barnes' car, blocking her exit from the gas station. If Barnes was engaged in a conversation with Swisher, Officer Swisher, and the second officer arrived, Barnes was still free to leave. She was still free to get in her car and drive off, although I contend that at that point Officer Swisher would not have let her get in her car and drive off.
My problem, I guess, with your analysis is it seems to me you're taking the hard road gratuitously. It's 5:30 in the morning. Police officer is engaged in a conversation with a motorist, keeping his eye on somebody in the car who's up to no good. And he calls for another officer. The other officer shows up, sees this situation. Why do we care whether at that point there's a stop or not?
We don't. We don't care if it's a stop or not. At that point, he certainly has reasonable suspicion for a stop. He certainly has reasonable suspicion. I maintain that he has reasonable suspicion before he ever pulls into the gas station.
The point of fact is, Officer Swisher at that point may have been 30 seconds from getting a bullet in his head.
Exactly.
There was an armed felon in the car with a weapon and bullets. And somebody was trying to shield him from the officer's view.
Absolutely. At that point, he had more than reasonable suspicion to approach that car, as Judge Moody found in his findings after the suppression hearing. As to the second issue raised by the appellant here, the jury instructions were correct in this case. First, the court's instruction 17 regarding possession is a correct statement of the law following the United States versus Lane case, decided approximately a year ago by this court.
Are the other ones not a correct statement of the law?
United States versus Connolly is...
Supplemental instructions, an incorrect statement of the law?
Yes, they were an incorrect statement of the law.
In what respect, Mr. Bush?
Well, first of all, with respect to the first supplemental instruction, it's a mere proximity instruction. That part of the instruction is not an incorrect statement of the law, but it's unnecessary to give, as this court has held, given the definition of possession, given the definition of knowing. It's duplicative, it's confusing to the jury, it's unnecessary. Also, as regards the touching of the firearm, mere touching of a firearm is not enough to constitute possession. Totally irrelevant in this case. It would have been very irrelevant to give that
under the defendant's view?
Well, it has to be under the defendant's view because the defendant testified that he held the gun. There's no evidence
he says
that
it was an innocent holding.
Well, he says it was an innocent holding, but there's no evidence that he merely touched the gun. He held the gun once, Ms. Barnes took it away from him, and then he held the gun a second time.
She's driving the car.
She's driving the car. Well, they're parked behind the oil exchange, or it's unclear exactly where they were when they found the gun.
That's right, but if she's driving the car, it makes kind of sense for him to hand for her to hand the gun back to him.
Well, he testifies that he takes the gun underneath the seat. He testifies that he sticks his hand under the seat. He grabbed the gun. He knew it was a gun. He had been convicted of 5 armed robberies. Convicted, not charged, convicted. He's convicted of 5 armed robberies. He reaches under the floor, under the seat of the car. He pulls out a gun. Ms. Barnes takes it away from him and says, oh, that's not a gun. He takes it away from her, puts it under the seat. He's still in constructive possession of the gun, even if he's
but
not
under the seat or between the seats initially. I couldn't
it's
tell.
It's under the seat.
When he took it back, he put it directly under the
seat. He put it under the seat, which is where it was found by Officer Swisher at the stop.
Okay. So, but that cuts kind of in his favor, doesn't it? I mean, he put it right back where he found it.
Well, he put it right back from where he found it, but he's still in constructive possession of the gun. If he was to pursue a justification offense, he was, according to him and Ms. Barnes, Officer Swisher arrived on the scene minutes after he found this gun. He never jumps out of the car and says, there's a gun under the seat. Ms. Barnes never says, there's a gun under the seat. Ms. Barnes tries to obstruct
Officer
Swisher's view.
When the officer first saw the weapon, Mr. Kirsch, where was it?
It was partly under the seat on the floorboard right underneath where the defendant was sitting.
However, visible to the officer from outside the car?
Yes. It wasn't totally underneath the seat. So as to the first instruction, as to the court's instruction 17, it's a correct statement of the law. The defendant relies on United States versus Connolly, dicta in that case, but he misreads the dicta in that case. That case says that the Seventh Circuit has made it clear that holding a firearm is a felon in possession of the firearm. A felon possesses a firearm is holding. It doesn't say our case law makes clear that touching a firearm or holding it only for an academic period of time does not establish possession. It merely addresses only what the Seventh Circuit has had the opportunity to address so far.
How about the second supplemental instruction? Is that a correct statement of the law?
The second supplemental instruction regarding abandonment and identity, I don't think it's necessary to address whether it's a correct statement of the law, because there's no evidence here that the defendant didn't know it was a gun, or the defendant didn't know it was a gun, and there's no evidence the defendant ever tried to abandon the gun, in the sense that an innocent possession instruction may be a correct statement
what
of the law.
What do you think was necessary for him to do when he realized there was a weapon in that car under the seat he was sitting in? What's he going to do under those circumstances?
Well, first thing he should have done in this case was notified Officer Swisher immediately that there was a gun. According to his testimony, he found out that there was a gun under the seat. He was right across the street from the Lowell police station. And at some point, he was out of the car. He could have very easily gotten out of the car and had Miss Barnes take the gun over to the Lowell police station. He could have distanced himself to the gun. He can't remain in constructive possession of the gun and maintain that he's not in actual or not in possession of the gun, that it's merely innocent.
So he'd be in better shape if he had gotten out of the car at the same time she did and said, "Officer, there is a weapon in this car. It doesn't belong to either one of us. I want you to know it's there."
Absolutely, he would have been in better shape. I don't know. I can't answer that question definitively under the case law as it currently stands in the Seventh Circuit. It's not exactly clear.
I said in better shape.
I don't know the answer to that question. Unless the court has any further questions, I simply ask the district court be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our next